This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium, good friends. And for those of you south of the 49th experiencing some unseasonably cold weather these days, I apologize on behalf of all Canadians for the polar vortex. That's a Canadian for you, right? Apologizing for everything, including the weather. I don't know why we do that, but that's just the way we are. Before we unfurl the flag tonight, just a couple of programming notes. I'll be away for the next 2 weeks stomping around the American Northwest, not really at liberty to tell you what I'm doing there. That'll all be revealed in good time, my friends. So next week, my good friend, Patrick White, the founder of Conspiracy Culture, a pretty fine bookstore in Toronto. Patrick White will be in this chair delivering the goods. And as I say, Patrick is a purveyor of fine books and DVDs at the very popular bookstore Conspiracy Culture. He's a very thoughtful, passionate, knowledgeable, engaging young man. So you are in very good hands. He'll be joined by Joseph Farrell to talk about one of my favorite topics. I'm kind of sorry I'm missing this one. It's all about the transhumanist movement. People like Ray Kurzweil and some billionaire media magnate from Russia are teaming up, hoping to achieve something, nothing less than immortality, really, by the year 2045. That's the goal, immortality by 2045. The following week, Victor Vigiani will be guest hosting. Victor, of course, no stranger to the program, longtime UFO disclosure advocate, the executive director of Zealand News Network, and he'll be here with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, among other guests. And one more note. You know, in the radio business, it's sort of an unwritten rule that you don't promote the competition. But what do you do when the competition invites you over for a night? So with that said, I'm happy to announce I'll be sitting in for George Norrie on Friday, Jan 31st, into Saturday morning on Coast to Coast. And I hope you can listen in for a night of open lines. In truth, I really don't see Coast to Coast as the competition. As I said, we're working towards a common end here, and that's to wake people up, encourage people to think for themselves, and challenge conventional wisdom. And many of the people I've had on this show, you've probably heard on Coast to Coast, and I know of many of you who listen to this show also listen to Coast. So very thrilled once again. It's been about 5 years since I sat in on and guest hosted the program. So looking forward to that, and I hope you can join me. So that's where you'll find me next Friday night. Just a reminder that the website is back up, richardserrett.com. Don't forget to register and subscribe to a new weekly newsletter, as yet unnamed, that I'll be rolling out, and I've set a goal of 500 subscribers before I start publication. So get on and register. Again, richardserrett.com. You'll also notice on the homepage beneath the This Week on the Show section is a featured book or DVD of the week, and this week's book happens to provide the framework for the next hour's conversation. The book is called Hunting Hitler, New Scientific Evidence That Hitler Escaped Nazi Germany. Wow, talk about challenging conventional wisdom. In 2009, three U.S. professors with access to Adolf Hitler's alleged remains startled the world with scientific DNA proof that the skull and bones that Russia had claimed since the end of World War II were Hitler's actually belonged to a middle-aged woman whose identity remains unknown. This announcement has rekindled interest in the claim made by Joseph Stalin, who maintained at the end of his life that Hitler got away. And the truth is that no one saw Hitler and Eva Braun die in the bunker in Berlin on April 30, 1945. No photographs were taken to document claims Hitler and Eva Braun committed suicide. Hitler's body was never recovered. No definitive physical evidence exists proving Hitler died in the bunker in Berlin. And the author of Hunting Hitler joins me now on The Conspiracy Show. Dr. Jerome Corsi explores the historical possibility Hitler escaped Nazi Germany at the end of World War II. Jerome, welcome once again to The Conspiracy Show, my friend. How are you?
I'm good, Richard. Good to be back with you. Thank you.
And congratulations. You know, I know that what I'm about to ask may sound, I don't know, bizarre, but you know, I genuinely believe there are people out there who think this way, and so I have to ask the question. Some people out there are thinking, this happened almost 70 years ago. Why do we care? Why are we writing about it?
Well, the key issue is that this is, I got interested because this is how intelligence agencies create disinformation. And it's a classic case of a cover-up by the U.S. government that the deep secrets on Hitler's death that the U.S. intelligence agencies knew the American people couldn't handle, so they, you know, determined to commit a huge crime. The intelligence agencies decided to lie, and disinformation was created. Disinformation was that Hitler and Eva Braun killed themselves in the dual suicide in the Führer bunker in Berlin at the end of World War II. That's all a lie. So it's not a old story. It's, you know, basically when you uncover what the lie is, you're going to uncover how much of the, you know, Nazis became what was the World War II aftermath, the Cold War, and the emergence from World War II, which was engineered by U.S. intelligence to produce who we are today.
And explain why the U.S. intelligence agencies, and I guess at the time it would have been the OSS and then later the CIA, why would they have gone along with this charade?
Because we helped Hitler escape. That's the dirty secret at the heart of this. Hitler escaped because Alan Dulles, who headed the OSS in Bern, Switzerland, engineered it. But I'd like to get there with people having enough time to absorb how this is credible, because that's the deep secret we're going to reveal tonight.
Yes, I mean, this is this is the bombshell that you drop in the book. So let's get into that indeed. Let me just remind listeners, Jerome Corsi is my guest and the author of Hunting Hitler, New Scientific Evidence That Hitler Escaped Nazi Germany. Now, Jerome, Let's just back up before we get into, I guess, the reasons why. If I could just talk a little bit about, you know, the remains that the Soviet Union, you know, had for so many years and believed or helped, you know, lead the world to believe that Hitler had committed suicide. And as you say, Stalin contended to the end of his days that it was not Hitler. Did President Truman not also state publicly on more than one occasion he didn't believe Hitler had died?
Well, not so much Truman. I think Eisenhower, at least one time, I said it in the book, Eisenhower, at the end of World War II, gave a statement to Dutch newsmen. It was printed in Stars and Stripes, which was the army newspaper at the time, that he had reason to believe that Hitler was still alive. It was a pretty startling statement for 1945. And it was really Jimmy Burns, who was the Secretary of State for Truman at the Potsdam Conference, that Stalin told. Stalin believed that Hitler had survived, despite Russia producing all this evidence that Hitler committed suicide. And Stalin told Jimmy Burns that he thought the United States helped Hitler escape. That was the Stalin was aware of what happened. And so, you know, the U.S. government was fully aware that Hitler escaped from the very time it happened. But I think the key, the story begins really, I started in it in 2009. There was a History Channel special on Hitler's escape, and it showed this Dr. Nicholas Bellatoni, who was the state archaeologist in Connecticut, and he was given 1 hour to look at the Hitler skull fragments in Moscow. He got access to the Russian Federation State Archive collection and building, where they had the Hitler skull, the skull that Russia had kept since the end of World War II, as proof that Hitler died at the end of World War II. And Bellatoni took samples from the skull. You can see it in the video. He brought them back to the Connecticut Center for Applied Genetics and Technology at, in Connecticut. A molecular biologist who ran the center ran DNA testing, and the skull, the Hitler skull that Russia had since the end of World War II, was found to be the skull of a 40-year-old woman. Clearly not Hitler, not Eva Braun, because Eva Braun was 33 years old, and the Russian autopsy supposedly showed that this Eva Braun corpse had died from cyanide poisoning, but the skull that was the Hitler skull clearly had bullet holes in it, but it was a 40-year-old woman. So clearly the Russians picked up some skull outside the Hitler, bunker in Berlin before the Russians, or after the Russians, took over the bunker in April 1945, and brought this skull back to Russia and said, this is Hitler, but it's all fraudulent evidence. And that's pretty shocking.
I'll say, but one has to ask, why did it take to 2009 for them to conduct, a pretty straightforward test on a skull to make that determination, Jerry?
Well, because the Russians had never allowed the skull to be really examined. Increasingly, over time, the Russians have let more and more information out of the archives. They've, allowed books to be published in Great Britain on the autopsies of Hitler and Eva Braun, which have raised dramatic questions as I examine in the book Hitler, Hunting Hitler. But the point was that finally by 2009, when a scientist got access to the Hitler skull and did DNA testing, it was clear that this was a fraudulent deal. The Russians had no definitive proof, no physical evidence that Hitler died. But yet the skull had been presented fraudulently to the world as if it were proof. And that was pretty shocking because, I began saying, okay, as I watched that documentary and studied it, said, if Hitler did not die, there's no definitive proof that Hitler died in the Führer bunker, then what happened? What are the lies? What happened to Hitler? How did he escape? And that's what really began my investigations.
The other question that comes immediately to mind, Jerry, is, think of it, this information that Stalin, he suspected it, but the height of the Cold War, if he knew this, that's pretty damning evidence to embarrass and undermine the United States. Why didn't Stalin pursue that further?
Stalin was in a real bind. I mean, first of all, at the end of World War II, You're dealing with Adolf Hitler, who is one of the greatest mass murderers, criminals in history. Started World War II, 60 million people, minimum, died as a result of Hitler's starting World War II. The Holocaust, the attempt to do genocidal murder on Jews in Europe. And if Stalin had to admit that Hitler got away, it would be a huge embarrassment and difficulty for the Russian regime when, tens of millions of Russians were killed by the Nazis. Nobody wanted to admit Hitler got away. Everybody wanted Hitler to come to some kind of justice. And if Hitler had committed suicide in the bunker, he was dead, that was acceptable as justice. If Hitler had been allowed to get away, the peoples of Russia and peoples of the world would not have accepted that.
All right, we'll take a quick time out. When we come back, we'll find out why U.S. intelligence agents in Europe, including the OSS and Alan Dulles, who later headed the CIA under President Eisenhower, helped Hitler escape, as they did with so many other Nazis. Jerome Corsi, my guest, the author of Hunting Hitler, New Scientific Evidence That Hitler Escaped Nazi Germany. Back with more in a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back. For years, the idea that Hitler escaped Nazi Germany and lived out his life, according to various accounts, places like Spain or perhaps South America. I mean, that was the fodder for the grocery store tabloids like the Weekly World News. But now it now seems as if we're getting irrefutable proof that at least Hitler did not commit suicide and that the Soviets did not have possession of his remains, based on a testing by a Connecticut state archaeologist who was allowed by the Russian Federation State Archive in Moscow to examine skull fragments the Russians have claimed for decades are proof Hitler committed suicide. And now we're finding out that's not Hitler's. Those are not Hitler's remains. So what happened to Hitler and Eva Braun? This is the subject of Jerome Corsi's new book, Hunting Hitler, New Scientific Evidence That Hitler Escaped Nazi Germany. And of course, Jerome Corsi, no stranger to this program, Harvard PhD, a senior staff reporter with WorldNet Daily. And he's authored many books, including the number one New York Times bestsellers, The Obama Nation and Unfit for Command, and Who Really Killed Kennedy? And his latest book, as I say, Hunting Hitler. All right, so let's go back to the OSS, the precursor to the CIA, and why exactly they would have been a part of this, you know, the greatest hoaxes in history, perhaps.
Well, Richard, the OSS was headed in Bern, Switzerland, by Alan Dulles during World War II. Alan Dulles, of course, was later the head of the CIA in 1953 under Eisenhower. His brother was John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State under Eisenhower. John Foster Dulles is the person whom the Dulles Airport in Washington is named after. Well, the Dulleses, before World War II, working with Brown Brothers Harriman, Averell Harriman's family Wall Street firm, and Cromwell and Sullivan, a New York law firm, had helped Hitler. They funded Hitler in the 1930s rise to power. It's one of the dirty, dark secrets of American Wall Street politics. And their compatriots in doing this, by the way, were the Bush family progenitors, Prescott Bush and George Herbert Walker, who were running, along with the Dulleses, a Nazi bank, Union Bank, in New York until 1941, after Pearl Harbor, when FDR closed down the bank. But that's where the Dulleses began. They were Hitler supporters from the beginning. Now, in 1943, when Alan Dulles was in Bern, Switzerland, heading the OSS, Martin Bormann, who was number two to Hitler, Hitler's secretary, and Himmler, also very close to Hitler, realized that Germany may lose the war. So there was a plan concocted by Bormann called Aktion Adlerflug, which was Action Eagle Flight. And what Bormann decided to do was to take the Nazi loot, billions of dollars, ill-gotten gain, bullion stolen from the countries that the Germans took, conquered, gold from the teeth of the Jews, killed the concentration camps. And Alan Dulles, OSS, had in Bern, Switzerland, worked with Bormann and invested the Nazi ill-gotten loot, criminally obtained, in the U.S. stock market, in Argentina, other countries, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, Turkey. Basically, Bormann created some 980 front companies outside Germany, plus 770 in neutral countries, including 98 in Argentina alone, many in the United States, where Bormann and the Nazis owned major portions of these companies to fund not only their escape, but also their rise to power with a united Europe and U.S. corporations working with German corporations to fuel the post-war world war.
And Jerry, if I could just interject for a moment, and for those people out there who are, slapping their head and saying, this can't be, need we remind them that Prescott Bush was charged under the Trading with the Enemy Act.
That's correct.
And this part I have heard, and you can disavow me of this if it's not true, but I have heard that as part of that sentencing, Prescott Bush was supposedly, he and his family were supposedly forbidden from holding public office, and yet we had presidents 41 and 43. Is that true?
Yes, and also Prescott Bush ran for office. He was elected to Congress from Connecticut. So, I mean, it was all wink-wink because before World War II, it was widely understood by the FDR government, the FDR administration, that we were the rise of Hitler. Wall Street funded Hitler. And as World War II was still in progress, 1943, we're just now invading North Africa with Operation Torch. I mean, there's a lot of war to occur. There's a lot of Americans going to lose their lives. You have Borman with Alan Dulles setting up major money center bank accounts, working with National City Bank, which is now Citibank, Chase, which is now J.P. Morgan Chase, manufacturers Hanover in New York to establish bank accounts for the Nazis. You had German U-boats starting to arrive in Buenos Aires at the rate of 6 to 8 a week and intervals all through 1943 and 1944, carrying gold bullion, art treasures that Hitler had stolen from the Jews and others in Europe. Over $50 billion in the gold alone transferred by Borman to Buenos Aires in, 1943 dollars, which is an enormous amount of money today. Jewels, rare coinage, art treasures brought by the submarines to Argentina. And the Nazis, as part of the deal, Dulles, the OSS, agreed the Nazis would be allowed to escape, including Adolf Hitler.
And what was the thinking that if they could resettle Hitler in some place like South America, Buenos Aires or Brazil later, that they could resurrect this Fourth Reich?
Well, it's extremely interesting because, Richard, if you look at it, if you had offered Hitler that he could have control of the European Union with Germany, the German central bank controlling the euro, arrangements with the United States, with corporations in both countries as sister companies working together, transatlantic partnership, which we're putting into place under President Obama, ignoring U.S. sovereignty to even closer knit a corporate state between Europe and the EU, plus an NSA and a CIA that could listen much better than the Gestapo to every conversation, every email in America, Hitler would have signed up in a day. He said, "This is my deal." So in a sense, what we've become, the world that was created, the Nazis never quit. They transition from an attempt to conquer Europe by war to conquer Europe through the deceit that set in place the EU. Just a trade agreement, but ultimately it compromises sovereignty of all the European countries, and they're now all together under a European Union run by bureaucrats out of Brussels and Luxembourg, with Germany controlling the EU central bank and the EU economy. So, I think the whole plan, the whole, Deutschland über alles was never abandoned by the Nazis, despite the fact that they lost the military war. And it wasn't that Dulles permitted a few Nazis to escape. We're talking about tens of thousands of Nazis.
Many of them who escaped the hangman's noose at Nuremberg ended
Correct.
Up, running the rocket program and so forth in the United States. There was a great line from, I believe it was All the Right Stuff, which was a movie about the space race. And there's a conversation between some American astronauts, debating, well, who's going to make it to the moon first, us or the Ruskies? And the one astronaut says to the others, well, we're going to win because our Nazis are better than their Nazis.
Well, and in fact, if you take a hard look at Operation Paperclip, which Alan Dulles engineered and put into place, Operation Paperclip was designed to bring over thousands of Nazi scientists, engineers, technicians and put them into U.S. business, including Wernher von Braun. And Wernher von Braun, you know, was the head of the V2 program, worked with the Gestapo, used Jewish slave labor to build the V2 rocket. We, wink, wink, forgot all about that, and Wernher von Braun ends up a huge hero, and he's running John Kennedy's plan to put an American on the moon, created our first ballistic missiles carrying U.S. nuclear weapons, and we did this, you know, we even brought over the Nazi scientists who invented the Zyklon B that was used by IG Farben to produce the poison that killed the Jews in the concentration camp.
And was that not developed in conjunction with Standard Oil?
Well, Standard Oil was part of the deal, of working with U.S. corporations, Standard Oil, and the oil industry, and specifically funding the synthetic oil industry of Germany, which the United States Standard Oil did. Henry Ford, IBM, there were any, ITT, the list goes on of the U.S. corporations in the 30s that knitted themselves together with Nazi counterparts. And after the war, these, you know, Bormann putting the investments back into the U.S. companies, continued the relationship between Nazi Germany and U.S. corporations in the post-war era. That's the, you know, basically Bormann and Dulles, Alan Dulles and CIA, early CIA, I mean, working for the OSS in Bern, Switzerland, put together all the arrangements where this Nazi loot got surreptitiously taken out of Europe through financial agents in Switzerland and invested in the U.S. stock market to all these U.S. corporations.
This is I got to ask you, Jerry, you know, as an American, and I'm not sure how old you are. I'm guessing that you had, you know, relatives, probably people close to you, that fought in the Second World War.
Of course. My father fought in the Second World War.
Same with my dad. And I'm thinking, Mike, as you're starting to connect the dots and you realize, you know, that this to call it shameful is an incredible understatement.
Oh,
this is
crazy.
A horror. This is a horror show.
Right.
How does it make you feel as you begin to realize this is happening?
It's disgusting because look, I mean, it's more than disgusting. It's there's no terms to explain it because what the Dulles and Bormann were doing were they were taking Nazi stolen loot from some of the greatest crimes ever committed in human history, robbing Jewish homes of art, robbing Jews of the gold in their teeth. Plundering the treasuries of the countries that Nazis invaded, taking their gold bullion. I mean, the crimes are horrendous. And yet, Wall Street, Alan Dulles, wink, wink, puts the money into U.S. corporations. It's all done surreptitiously with the aid of financial agents. Everybody makes money. It starts in 1943, and we haven't even invaded D-Day yet. 500,000 Americans lost their lives in World War II.
Exactly. And for what?
Canadians. How many Canadians lost their lives in World War II? You know, and all based on the premise that we were fighting the evil of Nazi Germany, the evil of, you know, Imperial Japan, when in fact, behind the scenes, Alan Dulles, the Dulles brothers, others including the Bush family, Wall Street, were wink, wink, in partnership with the Nazis and preparing for the post-World War, you know, forward the Nazis to essentially escape and survive with their loot.
Now it starts to make sense why, you know, the economic powerhouse of Germany at the time, IG Farben, was virtually left alone during the Allied bombing raids. You know, why was that left to stand?
Well,
and, you know...
Right, exactly. I mean, it was clearly strategic. And John McCloy, who was key in doing a lot of the planning of the U.S. bombing raids, strategic bombing raids, not only refused to divert any bombing to, you know, bomb Auschwitz and trying to save some Jews by bombing the railroads going to Auschwitz or bombing the crematorium, John McCloy also ends up in the Warren Commission. And by the way, when I wrote my book, Who Really Killed John Kennedy, I also put Alan Dulles at the center of the villains because John Kennedy figured this out and he would not fight the lying CIA wars in Cuba and in Laos and in Vietnam. John Kennedy fired Alan Dulles and was going to break up the CIA into 1,000 pieces,
well,
as well as destroy the Federal Reserve, which John Kennedy said we don't need to preserve to print our money.
And he was going to scale down Vietnam, and one of the great beneficiaries of Vietnam, of course, was Bell Helicopter. And who was running Bell Helicopter? Walter Dornberger, another German that was exfiltrated out of Nazi Germany. Back with more of my conversation with Jerry Corsi, Hunting Hitler. Stay with us. What was it Richard Condon said, the author of The Manchurian Candidate? You know, when you look at your sort of your worst fears and your worst suspicions, the truth is probably far worse. And it sounds like that's the case. We're discussing Jerome Corsi's new book, Hunting Hitler, New Scientific Evidence That Hitler Escaped Nazi Germany. And the evidence seems to be in that the remains that have been in the hands of the Russian Federation for nearly 70 years are not those of Hitler. This has been established. DNA, jury's in on this one, folks. So then the question is, what happened to the Führer? So let's pick up the trail, Jerry, and April 30th, 1945, as best as you can piece together, what happened to Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun?
Well, Richard, I mean, most of my research is based on documents. I mean, I went to the National Archives. It took me 2 years to find the file of U.S. military records at the end of World War II searching for Hitler. And it was shocking when I found them, finally. I mean, I show you in the book, here's a letter from J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, to the American Embassy in Buenos Aires. It's dated November 13, 1945. The subject, Hitler hideout in Argentina. And J. Edgar Hoover knows exactly where Hitler is. He says, you know, he's telling the FBI agents in South America that this Mrs. Eichhorn, and the Eichhorns were two very prominent industrialists. They had funded Hitler during the 1920s. They emigrated to Argentina. They owned this grand hotel in, you know, the German area of Argentina, La Falda, Argentina. And Hitler says that the Eichhorns have made arrangements. They're starting to build a large estate for Hitler, and they had arranged for Hitler's escape to Argentina. And I found the documents that that Hitler came to Germany in this U-boat 530 that arrived in Mar del Plata in Argentina on July 10th, 1945. The archives in Washington had even a newspaper from Argentina when the submarine arrived. And perhaps most startling, here was a naval intelligence attaché from Buenos Aires, writing back to Naval Intelligence in Washington, July 18, 1945, after the submarine surfaced, saying that, you know, reports say that the submarine was sighted by the Argentinian Navy about the middle of June, a month before it showed up and surrendered in Mar del Plata. It refueled and had offloaded VIPs along the shore in Buenos Aires, and the submarine then made its way. Another submarine, they reported, was going to be arriving in Buenos Aires, which it did. Subsequent to this, another submarine showed up in Buenos Aires. And the last sentence of the report says, Eva Braun and Adolf Hitler were landed in the south of Argentina by this submarine. And so, you know, the U.S. Naval Intelligence, in addition to J. Edgar Hoover in Washington, knew that Hitler had arrived in this submarine to Argentina and was completely covered up and lied by the American government, which chose to go with this cover story that had been fabricated for historian Trevor Roper, who wrote a book in 1947, a British graduate student in history, who wrote a book on Hitler's final days that told this soap opera story of Hitler and Eva Braun committing a dual suicide in the Führer bunker, and it never happened. We had documented evidence now in the archives from the FBI and Naval Intelligence that knew in 1945 exactly how Hitler escaped.
This is monumental. I mean, this is absolutely mind-blowing. Now, let me ask you, because as you mentioned in the book, the U-boat, the U-530, after it drops Hitler and Eva Braun off in Argentina, it goes on to surrender at Mar del Plata.
Mar del Plata, yes.
Now, so whatever happened to the sub-commander Otto Wormuth? I mean, did he ever speak about the fact that Hitler was on board? Or
we took him into custody and the crew into custody, and they all lied. See, the commander of this U-530, Wormuth, was only 25 years old. And what naval intelligence told Washington from Buenos Aires was that they had reason to believe that the real commanders of the boat had been offloaded. This was just, you know, one of the younger guys who got left to bring the boat into port and surrender it.
The fall guy. Listen, and I got to take a time out.
The fall guy.
We'll take a time out. We'll come back. Hot on the trail of Adolf Hitler with Jerry Corsi, back with more of The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. Now, there's a program that I like to think that we try to aim for the head or the heart occasionally, but once in a while we hit you right in the gut, and I think that's what we're doing tonight. Almost get this sort of deep down sickening feeling when you realize that what Jerry Corsi has pieced together in Hunting Hitler, new scientific evidence that Hitler escaped Nazi Germany, sort of piecing together and connecting the dots for something that we've sort of suspected but never have been able to articulate, something that's not right. We've known this deep down, I guess. And we think about, for example, the creation of someone like an Osama bin Laden and whether or not he, in fact, you know, died when we're told he died. All of these things now are suspect. We have to question everything now. Jerry, so Adolf Hitler lands in Argentina with Eva Braun aboard a U-boat, a German U-boat. Where does he go from there?
Well, first he goes to with the Eichhorns up into La Falda, north of Buenos Aires, to this German community, the Eden Hotel, and has absconded away. I mean, his appearance has been changed. They've done plastic surgery and they built a resort. The Eichmanns have been, since 1943, building a resort for Hitler down in Patagonia in Bariloche, very south of Argentina, near Chile in the Andes. It's a remote area. And this resort is a huge resort. It's 6,000 square feet, a rustic resort. 1,000 acres of land. You can only reach it by seaplane, so it's protected by dense forests on all sides. The look and the feel of the resort is very Bavarian. It looks like the Oberalpsberg retreat above the town of Berchtesgaden in the Bavarian Alps, where Hitler had his great, you know, picture glass lookout on the mountains retreat. During World War II, Hitler moved into this resort in Bariloche in June 1947, and the reports in Argentina say he lived with Eva Braun until 1965.
1965, which would have made him how old?
Close to 80.
80 years old. And died of what? Do we know?
Natural death, old age, buried or remains, you know, probably cremated and the remains gone. I mean, no visible burial site. But, you know, in Argentina, my wife is Argentinian. I speak Spanish. I've been working on this for years now. And in Argentina, there's two recent books, a couple of great authors, one of them an Italian, who have written books on Hitler escaping to Argentina, working in the Argentinian archives. There's even been a DVD done showing Hitler's escape, a video showing people who knew Hitler, worked with Hitler, pictures of Hitler. I mean, it's very well known in Argentina that Hitler escaped to Argentina after the war.
So this is like the worst kept secret, that Hitler lived out his day. I mean, this is like the worst insult of all, that, you know, when you say things like Hitler died of natural causes, like that's
right.
that's like an extra shiv, you know, in the back, that this monster got to live out his days in this resort.
Exactly. I mean, it's why the disinformation of the intelligence agencies, including the Russians, who knew also. I mean, Stalin, remember, Stalin knew that the the bodies that the Russian army found at the end of World War II and claimed were Hitler's were fraudulent, that the autopsies were rigged, the dental evidence was the Russians captured Hitler's dentist and technicians and Eva Braun's, and they falsified the dental evidence and shoved them in the mouths of these corpses. I mean, it was all fake. Hitler escaped, and Stalin knew it. But, you know, Stalin's intelligence agencies and ours could not let this lie be known. And so they both created disinformation and went along with this British graduate student, you know, from Oxford, Trevor Roper. And I show in the book Hunting Hitler, within a few days after Trevor Roper arrived in Germany to do his great investigation and write his book, U.S. intelligence Major Saxe, S-A-X-E, handed Trevor Roper a memo which was the conclusions to his book before he even investigated anything. And it was this great story about, you know, how Hitler, Eva Braun, got into the Führer bunker, and Hitler did a will. They said goodbye to everybody. It was very tearful, and, you know, they committed suicide in the private quarters with pistols and cyanide. It's all a story written for a middle-class, you know, bourgeois audience by, you know, a not very talented playwright who thought the story would sell. The truth is that, you know, when you deal with Hitler, who is a homicidal maniac, a genocidal maniac, killed 60 million people, trying to eradicate the Jewish people from Europe, this guy is not going to, the last days, say, I better sign a will and marry my mistress. Hitler blamed the German people for not being up to him, not coming up to his standards.
I'm trying to understand
he was going to live another day to see Germany rise again.
Well, to what extent do you think he was successful? I mean, what was he doing down there? Was he pulling the strings behind some sort of Nazi international overseeing business operations and so forth?
Of course, the entire engineering of the European Union, the lie that was told Jean Monnet that this was just going to be a trade agreement. The Nazis knew that, you know, okay, war did not work to put Germany at the head of a united Europe. So they'll go the stealth route by trade agreements and undermine the sovereignty of the countries to build together a European Union. And Germany today has emerged heading the EU, leading the European Central Bank, running the euro. Hitler would love this position. This was, you know, the plan number two. If the Nazis could not win World War II and by force rule Europe, could be done by stealth and the convincing people of these trade agreements were in everybody's best interest, more lies, more intelligence agency concocted lies, where the Nazis, with all their plunder invested around the world in, let's say, 1,000 corporations that Bormann owned interests with Nazi major holdings, that are still in existence today, creating the World War II economic rise between the United States and Europe, and now knitting it together into a combined U.S.-EU with massive intelligence agencies, NSA and CIA. I mean, you know, remember, the Nazis were leftists. This whole idea was a business, you know, corporate world, corporate governance across borders with the governments willingly cooperating. But Hitler was the first to introduce universal health care. As long as you had a Gestapo and NSA listening to every conversation to put away anybody who disagreed with you, fascism from the left has been predominant since the beginning of time. You know, the leftists don't want to tolerate dissent, and the Nazi plan to dominate Europe could be achieved either through winning World War II, which the Nazis did not, or for winning the post-war peace, which the Nazis seem to have done pretty well at.
Well, it's true. I mean, a lot of people forget. I mean, they were the National Socialist Party, folks.
Yeah, they were.
And where did they get their racial hygiene laws and their ideas about hygienics, or from eugenics,
well,
rather,
much,
in the United States?
That came in the United States out of, you know, Henry Ford, Planned Parenthood, Margaret Singer, who was, you know, running Planned Parenthood. The whole idea was put the Planned Parenthood centers in the African-American communities in the United States. I've written about it extensively because, you know, genetics, we have to eliminate the black race. We have to eliminate the Jews, racial purity.
This was the defense of many of the people at many of the scientists at Nuremberg were saying, well, we were just doing what you were doing in the United States, you know, experimenting on your own inmates and so forth. Unbelievable.
Exactly. And, you know, and the same eugenics ideas, the same, you know, again, the intelligence agency lies that we defeated Hitler, so, you know, the genetics ideas were killed, all this, all those ideas simply went underground and took an economic form and are still today evident in the EU and the United States. We still have Planned Parenthood. We still have the EU. We still have the European Central Bank. President Obama is pushing now the Transatlantic Partnership to even knit further together U.S. corporations and their counterparts in Germany. I mean, the plan has not ever stopped.
You know,
and it was funded from the beginning, before World War II, by Alan Dulles and even the Bush family progenitors through Wall Street. The rise of Hitler, we funded Hitler. That's one of the deep, dirty secrets. And what I'm pointing out in Hunting Hitler, the second deep, dirty secret, is Alan Dulles and the OSS, the precursors of the CIA, we helped Hitler and the Nazis escape. And not just a few Nazis, tens of thousands of Nazis. By the time you look at the rat lines, the involvement of the Catholic Church and the Red Cross, getting these Nazi major criminals visas to go to Argentina, where they had false identities and the right to get citizenship and own land.
Are you hearing
businesses?
Are you hearing from veterans and the families of veterans from World War II after this book?
I have, yes, and I think, you know, it's beginning to wake people up. This in my book on who really killed Kennedy, in which I also made clear Alan Dulles' culpability and John Kennedy's resistance to this new world order. I think we've got to go back and reevaluate. That's my whole book on who really killed Kennedy. You've got to go back and reevaluate Kennedy, because John Kennedy understood. He gave a speech about secret societies. John Kennedy knew what was going on. He was trying to resist it. John Kennedy had lived. He would have broken up the CIA into 1,000 pieces. He would have broken up the Federal Reserve, which we don't need to print our money. John Kennedy understood that these forces were trying to push us in a direction of where the Nazis originally wanted to go.
Yes, and here we are in 2014 doing this long, inexorable march towards what I call soft totalitarianism. And minus the brown shirts, and now they're replacing the brown shirts with Armani suits on Wall Street and no more goose-stepping. It's a very sophisticated form, but it's really the same thing going on. We're like, you know, frogs in the boiling water, slowly turning up the temperature.
Plan A, the war for the Nazis, was just too crude. Plan B, everybody lies, the intelligence agencies, CIA, KGB, everybody else covers it up. The presidents were put into power are so owned by the New World Order that they create free trade agreements and lie about them. It's all, you know, hush, hush, wink, wink. Sell that it's going to be good for the economy, and it's the low road, you know, not war, but lying, and the economic road to achieve the same purposes the Nazis wanted to achieve in World War II through war.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for spending the last hour with me. Congratulations on the book, and some startling conclusions, I'm sure, were not pleasant for you to have to confront.
No, book I wish I did not have to write, but it's, you know, again, look at the book, look at the evidence in the book, because everything I write is based on documents, based on hard evidence. Found them in the archives. I found the DNA did not support the conclusion that there was any evidence Hitler had died at the end of World War II. Before you dismiss these ideas, go look at the evidence.
All right, Jerry. Thank you so much.
Okay, Richard. Thank you.
Jerome Corsi. Hey, you can follow this show, richardserrett.com. All the information is there. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett. And as always, follow the truth. Thank you for your ears. My name is Richard Serrett. This is a program that serves as a friendly reminder that even the mightiest oak tree started out as a nut. And I say that because much of what we talk about on this program is not for everyone, quite frankly. Much of the information heard here would, in certain quarters, be dismissed, ridiculed, perhaps even aggressively opposed. And repeating some of the things you hear on this show might even get you crossed off a few Christmas card lists. Believe me, I know that firsthand. But relax, now you're among friends and like-minded individuals. Just a reminder, I'm off over the next 2 weeks, and Patrick White, the founder of Conspiracy Culture here in Toronto, will be sitting in next week. And the following week, the director of Z News Network, Victor Vigiani, will be in air chair, and I know you will treat them with the utmost respect. It's like, do you remember when you were in school and you had a substitute teacher and you thought you could get away with hell, right? Come on now. I'm warning you. I'm not warning. I'm asking you. Treat them well. And because you're going to be in good hands. These are very knowledgeable, passionate individuals. In fact, we're going to welcome Victor Vigiani onto the program here in just a moment. Just another programming note, though, and that is just to remind you that next Friday, January 31st, I'll be guest hosting Coast to Coast, sitting in for George Norrie. It's been about 5 years since the last time I got a call up to the Yankees, as I like to say. But, you know, I think I mentioned this before. I don't look at Coast to Coast as competition. We're all sort of working towards a similar purpose, right? And that is to wake people up, to get people to think for themselves. And really, the people that I have on the program as well, many of you who listen to this program, you listen to Coast to Coast, you've heard many of the guests on this show on Coast, and we're just one big family trying to expose the truth, that's all. And another gentleman who's no stranger to this program, and you've also heard him on Coast, has been working diligently for many years to expose the truth as it pertains to the field of study involving UFOs and ETs, part of this vast UFO disclosure network. And it's always a pleasure when Richard Dolan agrees to come on the program. He is among the world's leading researchers and historians of the UFO subject. He's the author of 2 volumes of history, UFOs and the National Security State, Parts 1 and 2. If you don't have those books in your library, get on down to Conspiracy Culture. My good friend Patrick White, I'm sure, has those in stock. You really need to have those if you're going to be sort of, you know, forewarned and forearmed about what's really going on. And we're going to delve into that some more tonight, because Richard has another book, another must read. This time he's taking a look at not only the whole history of the cover-up, but he's really drilling down and analyzing the nature of the cover-up. The new book is UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, and he's here along with the aforementioned Victor Vigiani, my co-pilot whenever we discuss UFOs and ETs on the program. Victor, of course, is the executive director of Zealand News Network and also has been diligently working on behalf of the UFO disclosure movement as well for many, many years. First of all, let's say hello to my good friend Victor. How are you, my friend?
Just fine, Richard, and great to be with you again.
And the aforementioned, of course, Richard Dolan. Richard, you're going to be in Toronto soon. What's going on?
Hi, Richard. Yes, I'm going to be in Toronto in less than 1 week on Thursday the 30th for something that's really exciting. This is not a typical sit-on-your-butt UFO conference. This is a party for truth. That's what it's called. And I'll be there. Former Minister of Defense of Canada Paul Hellyer will be there. Another really cool researcher, Dan Dix, is going to be there. I had not known much about him, but he's a very, very interesting guy who does lots of work on GMOs and I think a lot of other important things going on in our world that I think people want to know about.
Yeah, he's a fine documentary filmmaker, yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy, I think. I'm looking forward to meeting him. And there's some live music. I think cheap tickets at the door. I think it's $20 gets you in. And it's going to be a wild time, and I'll be mingling. I will have my new book available for the very first time in public. I'm quite excited about that. It's taken me 2 years to write this thing. And it's more than just about the cover-up. I don't want to spend the whole time talking about this book, but I will just say it's really a new, complete summary of the entire UFO phenomenon. This is really my attempt to bring a fresh approach to the entire field. I mean, when you really think about the study of this topic since, say, the 1950s, since it really kind of had serious people looking at it, the field really exploded only in the last 20 years or so, really with the birth of the internet and with a lot of new opinions coming in, a lot of new ideas coming into the field. And it occurred to me that there really hasn't been a very a kind of a unified, comprehensive look at everything. That is the history, that is the politics, that is the science, the crazy science associated with the UFO phenomenon, everything from propulsion to string theory to consciousness itself, as well as talking about things like disclosure, which is a big issue in the field, and so many, many other aspects of this topic, the nature of contact itself or alleged contact, and then the nature of how do you distinguish what is a UFO when we have got drones all over in the skies these days and off-the-shelf technology can confuse, you know, the hell out of people. And all of these other issues that are relevant for today. I talk to people who have no idea how fascinating, I mean, absolutely fascinating, mind-blowing the UFO phenomenon really is because they just haven't been turned on to it. And really what I've written is like a 500-page love letter to the field of UFOs telling people why it's the most incredible mystery of our time, why it actually will transform your reality if you just give it an opportunity to delve into it. And it'll change your world. You got to be brave, but it'll do it for you.
And, well, there's a lot of people not ready to go there. I mean, we have spent, you know, you talk about the last 50 years, and we have groups like MUFON, and God bless them, but they're still sort of preoccupied with sort of categorizing and cataloging
exactly.
Reports. And,
right.
You know, a lot of other people say, okay, you had me, you know, 20 years ago. Let's take it to the next level. And there are many of those people who are not willing to go there yet, and you are, thank God, and also people like Victor Vigiani. I mean, are you still getting pushback and resistance from those groups because they're not ready yet and are willing to take it to the next level as you have done?
Well, I don't know. When I talk to people directly, I can tell you, Richard, they get turned on by this. They are into what I have to say to them. I have not ever met a UFO group or any kind of even casually interested person. If I can't get them for 5 minutes, I'm serious. And if I can't get them hooked, then I feel there's something wrong with me. I feel like this is a topic that I have given the last 20 years of my life to. I know it as well as anyone can know it at this point, at least who's been researching it. I'm not ashamed to say it. I've dove into it, and I'm as engaged by this topic as ever. So, no, I think what's been lacking is just I think there's been a lot of people in some of those groups who've just been on kind of an autopilot, and they've, you know, their mode is, well, let's collect the reports and let's collect the data. And I think they're just ready to be woken up. And it's not just me. There's a lot of other people out there who are looking at this phenomenon, I think, in a more contemporary way. And by that, I'm simply meaning without, you know, traditional sort of traditional political approach, traditional scientific approach. That is, old-fashioned ufology really didn't delve into deep, black budget conspiracy issues, and it needs to. It needs to because that's where a lot of the action is. Old-fashioned ufology did not delve into contemporary science issues like quantum mechanics, like string theory, like consciousness studies, and it needs to because that's where the action is. So I think really where a lot of the new ufology moving forward into this coming century is going to be moving in some of those directions. In other words, a sophisticated politics, sophisticated science, so that we can actually try to make some progress on this. That's why I call it UFOs for the 21st century mind.
Well, thank you for elevating, you know, the level of discourse on this subject. And Victor, you jump in here at any moment. But Victor, you know what I was getting at with Richard. You know more than most at how fractious and divisive the UFO community is. I mean, you've lived that firsthand as well. Talk to me a little bit about the importance of I'm almost talking like you're not in the room, Richard, or in on the conversation, but talk to me about the importance of Richard Dolan's work to the UFO disclosure movement.
Well, as you said off the top of the show, Richard, you mentioned Richard Dolan's first two books, The National Security State 1 and 2, both volumes, and I've always maintained that those two books, probably in addition to the other ones that he's written, but those two books are probably the seminal works in ufological history. The way he approached it as a historian, as a teacher, as someone who has a wealth of knowledge in the area, those two books could, if the universities in North America would allow it, could be the major components in the curriculum to have a launch point within the universities to begin this higher level of discourse about an issue in an anthropological kind of way, sociological and political way. And I think Richard's first two books, The National Security State 1 and 2, would be the launching point for any type of high-level post-secondary school examination of the way this issue has developed. And what brought Richard to the point to catalog what he did and wrote those two books in the way that he did, I'm not quite sure if it was just, you know, divine inspiration or just hard work or whatever it was, but Richard has really completely overtaken most UFO researchers in this field and brought to bear what I would call a fulcrum that switched us over from just looking at what UFOs are as lights in the sky and tipping that balance into a really political analysis of what this thing really means and sort of looking at the underbelly of society's grasp at and understanding of the madness and power and the collectivism and the status quo. And Richard, in both of those books, put facts out that challenged all of those issues.
Go ahead, Richard. Did you want to...
Oh, my God.
Did you want to add anything,
Victor?
Eulogy?
I speak the truth.
Yeah, when I'm dead, you're not with me, Victor. You've got the keynote address.
Hey, everybody wants to know what it would be like at their own funeral, so I just thought I'd... But we wish you a long, happy life.
Very gratified to hear that.
Well, Richard,
I just want to say that what Victor was saying about the academic approach, when I wrote those two volumes, UFOs and the National Security State, that is exactly what I was trying to set out to do. I wanted those books to be a solid intellectual fashion for the reality of the UFO phenomenon and the cover-up and, you know, dealing with the politics and also the research, but primarily the phenomenon and the cover-up. And I'm glad that you felt the same way, Victor.
Yeah, I think it's really important to make those distinctions because it's the first time it was ever done. And as I said earlier, if you wanted to look at a perfect academic approach to it, those would be the first two books that you'd want. There's lots of other good stuff out there too, but I mean the way you handle it, this fact after fact after fact. The only other book that I would think that would even rival what you're talking about is Terry Hansen's book regarding the media. That would be probably my third choice as a text.
Love Terry's work. That's a great book.
It's an absolutely missing time.
The Missing Times.
The Missing Times, just by Terry Hansen. And I have read that book. I'm just beginning the third reading of it right now. Every time I read it, very similar to yours, Richard, every time I read it, I gain new insights, new fascinating points. And it doesn't just reach into the UFO issue. I mean, Terry gets into issues like, you know, the American public was not told that there were over 300 ships sunk off the eastern coast by German submarines. And this is something that no one will ever talk about. And that's the underbelly of the way the media operates and the way the government forces the media to operate.
Sorry, Victor, to jump in, but I can't let that go past just to make sure I heard that correctly. German U-boats shot down, what, 300 UFOs?
No.
No, American vessels.
No, ships. ships.
Ah, okay.
Okay, like ships on the water.
All right. Otherwise, I would have had to clear the decks and talk about that for the next hour.
If they shot those UFOs down, that would explain the German UFO connection. That would have to be it.
All right. Listen, we'll take a time out. And Richard, I want to talk a little bit more about UFOs for the 21st century mind. We don't have you for a long time tonight. We'll have you on again. And talk some more, but we'll also get into this Party for Truth, and I know you're going to be doing this cross-country tour. But I do want to talk a little bit about sort of one of the things that you get into in the new book, and that is an analysis of the cover-up. And I love to hear you, because you do such a cogent job at explaining that, and I'll get you to do it again on the other side here. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show, Richard Dolan, Victor Vigiani. Stay with us. Richard Dolan is with us. He is coming to town. Give us the details on that again, Richard.
Yes, it's Thursday, January 30th, just 1 week from now, less than a week from now. I will be for the Party for Truth event that's in Toronto. The location is Lee's Palace at 529 Bloor Street West in Toronto. I think it starts at around 8 o'clock or so. It's $20 to get in, and I think there's going to be a lot of wild people there. Three live bands, myself, Paul Hellier, Dan Dix, a lot of cool people talking about a lot of things. I think it's just going to be a great kind of hangout, something, as I was just saying earlier, better than a boring sit-on-your-butt UFO conference. People are going to be out doing things, talking. I love to do these types of events. I love to mingle. I love getting younger people in particular involved in this topic. I love turning on their minds to why this is such an incredible topic. So I'm very grateful to be at this event.
And then you're taking it on the road.
That's right. A few months from now, not right away, but this is sort of a kickoff event. I will be doing a three-week tour of Canada along with another researcher, Michael Tellinger, very interesting guy, and a lot of local researchers along the way. We're actually doing a tour from Halifax to Vancouver and a lot of cities in between, 11 cities total, over a three-week period. I have never been across the entire mass of Canada before. This is my first time. I'm so looking forward to it. A little bit of trepidation. 3 weeks, a lot of it's going to be in a bus. I don't know how I'm going to like that, but we will find out. Lots of stops along the way, and I absolutely look forward to meeting all of the people of Canada that I can. I've been up to Canada many times. I love your country. I love the people in Canada. I love talking to the Canadians about this topic and all other kinds of topics that are off the beaten path. I think a lot of Canadians are really keen and are awake to a lot of the things that are happening in this world.
For those who aren't going to be able to see down at Lee's Palace next Thursday or aren't going to get out to any of the events during this three-week cross-Canada tour, you've got a captive audience right now. Just spend a few moments, if you could, just sort of setting the table in terms of what you mean by an analysis of the nature of the UFO cover-up.
Yeah. Well, when I wrote my first volume of UFOs in the National Security State, that book came out initially in the year 2000. It was a year and a half before 9/11. And I recall distinctly a lot of researchers said, oh, my God, this is a crazy radical book talking about a conspiracy. And I thought, what is wrong with these people? And then comes 9/11 and the entire world becomes radicalized. And suddenly I look at the thesis of my very first volume. And the thing that strikes me about it is how tame it is compared with where I think so many of us are today. Because what I did back then is simply delineate that, A, there's an absolutely real phenomenon of unknown craft that are penetrating sensitive airspace. We know this is not speculation. This is fact. We have declassified documents proving it. We know that the base commanders were concerned, and we know that they lied about it to the public. We know all of that. We know that this was a secret for years and years and years, and we know that there was collaboration with major media and major academia and all of that. So when I said that now 14 years ago, people were like, oh, my God, that's so radical. So now we've gone a little bit further. I think now the world has grown up a little bit, right, to the fact that we've got an utterly irredeemably corrupt global political financial system. So it's really not such a big deal for me now to go say to people, oh, yeah, well, there's this cover-up on this incredible phenomenon. So I think people are a little bit more awake to it. So how does it actually work? I think that when we talk about the structure of secrecy, right, I have to preface this by saying I'm not in the club, so they haven't really given me all of the details. But I think this is what happened. You go back to the 1940s. Pretend that you're the American president, because that's really, I think, where a lot of this truly crystallized and started. You're Harry Truman, and your top advisors have informed you that not only is there this crazy phenomenon that no one can explain with apparently radical technology, but that we recovered something of that their stuff, i.e. in a crash retrieval, say Roswell. And one of the things that I point out in all of my research, in particular this new book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, is a lot of crash retrieval evidence, quite a lot. So let's just say the U.S. military recovered exotic technology. What are they going to do with it? They're certainly not going to share it with the world. They can't. They cannot share it with the world. They're trying not to share the atomic bomb with the Russians. So why would they share something as exotic as alien technology? So what happened is that of necessity, an ultra classified program was put into place. And it has to be ultra classified in the sense that you can't even tell Congress about it. You can't let them know that they're funding it. So you have to create what we would call now a black budget. The UFO phenomenon, in other words, what I argue, is one of the creators of America's black budget culture, and really the global black budget culture, which has followed in its wake. So you get this culture of secrecy. You get these brilliant scientists studying this exotic technology in secret, and they come up with ideas. They come up with innovations. And they come up, in other words, with money-making opportunities. They have no incentive now for giving up the secret. And since the structure of power has become largely privatized, it's always been privatized for at least the last several centuries, certainly the last century. So the real nexus of power is outside of the true political system anyway. And we know this is true of the black budget system. It's all privatized. So what we're talking about is this kind of quasi-public, quasi-private group of powerful people who really run the show. You know, just a week or two ago, we had the news article that came out that the top 85 wealthiest people in the world own as much money as the bottom half of the human race. They have the top 85 people own as much money as the bottom 3.5 billion people. So that's, we're not talking about the top 1%. We're talking about the top 0.00001%. And that's how secrecy like this works. You've got a very few people who actually control what they control things. And everything else is deeply compartmented. You've got a very small group of people who are profiting from this, and they know what they want to know, and they go beyond nations at this point. The U.S. military is simply a police force for their use. That's it. So if they need the U.S. military to invade a country, to steal someone's oil, or to do whatever, they do that. If they need the U.S. military to guard their precious UFO secrets, then they do that too.
It sounds like they got it pretty locked down. Victor, jump in here, but I get the sense – I'm going to say this, and then I'll let Victor jump in. But I get the sense, Richard, that you know, based on your last two books, AD After Disclosure, and now this book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, you're sort of preparing us for the eventuality that this veil of secrecy is all about to come tumbling down imminently.
It's we're in a battle. We are. It's like in the 15th round of the toughest boxing match in history. We've got on the one side forces for kind of a global totalitarian police state, and they are moving in that direction. Everyone can feel it. Everyone can see it. Everyone can. And on the other side, yeah. Go on, Victor. No, I don't want to interrupt you.
No, I just wanted to make the point of what you're saying is that somehow, and perhaps unbeknownst to the higher levels and within the media, this whole UFO issue, and as you really articulated very well over the last 2 or 3 minutes, the UFO issue has given rise to an understanding of all of these other nefarious things that are going on. The police state of the American Army and military might throughout the globe, the oil industry, the end of fossil fuels, the corrupt nature of the economic system. The UFO issue, if people would look at it from that perspective, has allowed us to see all of the other kinds of things, the thin underbelly of what's really wrong with the planet. And I think refocusing, as what we're doing, people who in the research community, is really allowing people to focus, use the UFO issue to focus as a lens on all these other nefarious issues.
Well said. Well, very well said. I think that's what I was trying to say, and I think you put it very well, Victor. I will just to finish the thought about where we're headed, Richard. I think on the one hand, there's definitely forces for a global totalitarianism, and we're seeing it. It's happening constantly. You know, Barack Obama has been negotiating this Trans-Pacific, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, or whatever it is, which is the more you look at it, the more horrible it is. So there's those forces on the one side, and then on the other side is this wonderful thing. It's still alive. It's called the web, and it is still being used by the people. In other words, we have a global communication system where we are sharing information. We're communicating with each other every day. I'm doing this with you guys on Skype. You know, this type of communication just wasn't even available a little more than 5-6 years ago, and we've got so many tools now. We're doing all kinds of file sharing, both legal and illegal. I think the illegal is just as important as the legal, by the way, and it can't stop. In a few years, we're going to be having 3D printing, and I'll tell you right now, 3D printing is going to revolutionize this world, and it's going to allow not just ideas to be shared, but technologies to be shared, patented technologies, and probably some classified ones, too, are going to go up there. And just because it's illegal to share those doesn't mean they won't be shared.
Imagine in 15 years being able to print a new organ, you know, all part of this transhumanist movement.
And how about a new energy harvesting device that some smart person in Toronto or Kansas City or Calcutta creates, and you can download and create and go off the grid? You think that won't be possible? Bet it will. What we're seeing is a battle. This is the crystallization of the battle between the people and the elite, and it's going to happen. We're going to see it in the next 10, 15 years. The UFO mystery is part of this. It's not the only part of it, but it's a big part of it. And so where do I see this coming down? I don't know who's going to win. I don't know if we're going to end up, you know, as in Orwell's vision of a boot squashing down the face of humanity forever.
If we ain't there already.
Well, I know. It's rough. But we're not down totally. We're not dead yet. People are still awake. There's still people willing to speak out. And there's still enough economic pain out there that there may be people willing to listen. So where this will end up, I don't know. I'm certainly never going to count freedom and humanity out. Never. Never.
I mean, is there a timeline when you see this happening, this battle to end all battles?
I think a couple of technologies are accelerating this. I mean, you know, we're looking – we have things like WikiLeaks and Anonymous and these groups out there. These are a symptom of the technological developments that we've attained. I mean, in other words, WikiLeaks couldn't have happened 10 years ago because we didn't have the global infrastructure to allow it. Now we have that infrastructure. Now we have it. We have Edward Snowden. We have Anonymous. We have things like that. So let's look at the next 10 years, the next 20 years. Within the next 20 years, we are very possibly getting to a place where computers will have enough native artificial intelligence that they may pass what's called the Turing test. They may actually seem conscious. Whether they are or not, who knows? But they're going to be intelligent. We get to that point. Some have called it the singularity. That could be a real game changer right there. And even before we get to that, there are going to be new technologies coming online that may very well challenge the secrecy, like 3D printing, like new developments to smartphones. Who knows? I can't even imagine them all. So I would say within 20 years, we're going to see a major transformation. It could be 10 years. It could be tomorrow. But I would say conservatively 20 years, we're going to see a major transformation in the whole UFO reality, what we know. And that's going to cause a huge revolution, a real revolution. In other words, political, economic. Because, you know, you can't just come out there as the prime minister or as the president and say, yeah, apparently this is real, folks. You know,
and I'm guessing it's not going to. And I'm guessing it's not going to happen that way. Disclosure is not going to be a White House press conference.
It will only be forced. It'll only be when they're pressed to the wall, and they must, because something's happened. Either something's leaked or an event happens that's recorded. You can't deny it, and then they will do it. And then they'll lie. They'll continue to lie about it. But at least it'll be out on the table for people to talk about, and that'll be the difference.
Victor, what do you think?
The entire world.
Victor, what do you think is going to push it over the edge?
Well,
disclosure.
I think the whole idea of once this critical mass of an idea becomes, as Richard is talking about, so compelling that it will have to come out. When an idea of this quality, of this nature, of this transcendental nature comes about. And when one half of the world is capable of talking to the other half of the world in a split second, in a nanosecond, when I taught school, that was one of the things I was talking to children about. One day it's going to happen that one half of the world will be able to talk to the other half of the world in an instant, and it's happened. And really, it happened in the blink of an eye. Then the next leap is going to be when the ETs, whoever these beings are, and whatever they are, I'm not just saying who and whatever they are, but wherever they're from, be they time travel, once the ETs and once the idea of their presence becomes known as the conduit to the cosmos, and that's what's going to happen. Once the realization that these things are real and that these ETs are who they say they are, and in fact who they are, and we understand that they are the conduit for us to the rest of the cosmos, it will change the world in ways we won't even be able to understand.
All right, to be continued. And next Thursday, Jan 30th, at Lee's Palace here in Toronto is a great place to start, where Richard Dolan and the Right Honorable Paul Hellyer will be in attendance talking about much of what you've heard tonight. Richard, always a pleasure. Thank you, and we'll do this again soon and longer.
Loved it, Richard. And Victor, nice talking with you as well tonight.
Great stuff, guys. Thanks a lot.
Victor, Richard, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. When we come back, torture from above. You'll learn all from a medical doctor in San Antonio, Texas, as we discuss electronic harassment. Stay with us. And season three of the Conspiracy Show television program will be on the air at some point in 2014, there will be an announcement at some point. It's imminent, when you'll be able to watch brand new episodes of the Conspiracy Show across Canada on Vision TV. And of course, in the interim, seasons one and two are airing quite frequently on Vision, and I don't get a chance to watch them, nor do I necessarily want to look at my mug or listen to my voice constantly, so I don't often see the repeats. But the way I know which episode is airing is I'll receive, or in some cases inundated with emails asking me about, how this episode came together, or they want more information, or people are sharing their personal experiences. And a perfect example of this is I always know when an episode we did in season two on electronic harassment is airing, because I think that more than any other episodes garners more email and feedback than any of the dozens of episodes we've done. And again, just recently, the electronic harassment episode aired because I received probably about three dozen emails in the course of an evening talking about this. And many of those emails were people sharing their personal experiences. And again, these are from what I would consider, highly respected professional people. I mentioned several months ago, got an email from an emergency room doctor who's getting ready to retire. And then she said in the email, all of these strange things started happening to her, hearing voices in her head, telling her to harm herself or, to do things she wouldn't ordinarily think of doing. And now she says, my life is upside down. How am I going to enjoy my retirement? I have constant sleep disruption and all of these symptoms that I've heard, this common denominator from people time and time again. And I thought it was time that we talk about electronic harassment again on the radio. It's been a while. And recently, I happened to meet a gentleman, and I don't know how, after a dozen years doing this show, our paths have never crossed, and I've never had this gentleman on the air, but it's time to rectify it. He, too, is a medical doctor who hails from San Antonio, Texas, and he knows all about electronic harassment firsthand, really. This has touched his life in a very, very personal way, and in fact, it's all documented in his book, New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America, and we're about to learn how satellite technology is involved in this electronic torture and harassment and surveillance. This was an eye-opener for me because I'd always been led to believe that a lot of the technology these perps are using, and whoever these perps are, we're not sure, but I always was led to believe that their technology is ground-based, whether we're talking about some handheld, microwave technology being held up to an apartment wall. Not so, says Dr. John Hall, And we just have a few moments with him, but I wanted to make his acquaintance again live on the air and just spend a few moments talking about what is becoming increasingly a very, very important topic, and more people are waking up to this fact that electronic harassment is real, it's going on, and who knows, you know, you could be affected by it next. Dr. John Hall, that being said, welcome aboard. Welcome to the Conspiracy Show, finally.
Hey, Richard, thanks for having me. How are you tonight?
Very well, and as I say, I'm not sure why we've not talked before, but we're gonna rectify that tonight. I mentioned Dr. Hall, you're a medical doctor. How did you first learn about the reality of electronic harassment?
Well, I mean, honestly, I knew a little bit about it from some contacts within government circles that I have. It never really saw it as far as a problem with exposure on the general public, non-consensually, until I had a girl here in San Antonio that was complaining about stalking initially. Came to me as a friend, not necessarily her physician, as well as several other women in San Antonio came to me, voicing these really odd complaints, you know, hearing voices, being followed by, you know, organized groups of stalkers that were unknown to her. These weren't scorned loved ones or, you know, no reason that she would be under any type of, you know, police surveillance or anything, and break-ins. And I decided to, you know, kind of take her up on it. I've known this woman for a while. I knew she didn't have a drug problem, didn't have any known mental illness that I knew of. I'd known her a long time. So I gave her the benefit of the doubt, and, you know, I said, you know what, well, let's do some counter-surveillance. You know, this, you know, not typically what you would get from coming to your physician, I guess, but we started doing some counter-surveillance with her. Put digital voice-activated audio recorders in her condo. And sure enough, people were breaking into her condo. People were following her everywhere she went. We tracked the plate numbers down. They came back to a former FBI fraud investigator, now running a private investigative service in the San Antonio area, that hired nothing but his relatives to work for him. And I had heard of this individual before in professional circles, was told that he was the go-to guy if you wanted to harass your competitors. And medicine in San Antonio has become somewhat of an organized crime type situation here. It's so competitive that often does happen.
So the perps, in some cases, I mean, we tend to think in terms of some shadowy government agency, and they may be involved at some level. But in many instances, this technology or these tactics are being utilized by, as you say, you know, someone who's simply interested in running the competition out of whatever business it is, or it could be a neighbor that wants you out of their low rent or rent controlled apartment building.
That's exactly right, and I have met with a lot of victims who are being targeted by their homeowners associations. But at the base of it, the technology is still relatively classified and has to come from a government source. And if you look at any of the mind control or mind manipulation programs from the past, MKUltra and a number of any other of the programs that were under MKUltra, typically, the government didn't do the research or do the experimentation directly itself. It was usually done through a front company or guised as legitimate research through a university. And that's also what we're seeing today with electronic harassment. You know, like the people we identified here is a private investigative service. Of course, it's ran by a former FBI guy. Access to the technology is not something that you or I could usually directly come by.
All right, let me jump in here. Dr. John Hall, author of A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America. We'll find out what satellites have to do with electronic harassment when The Conspiracy Show continues right after this. I think most of us by now are waking up to the fact that we are living, you know, in the age of surveillance, and of course all of these revelations regarding the National Security Agency, and now we're learning things about, you know, all our computer routers, our internet routers have these back doors, and internet providers have these secret handshakes with the intelligence gatherers to allow them, you know, key loggers and web cameras now that activate when you don't even think your computer's turned on. Your cell phone can be activated. Then we had, of course, the case of the Washington naval shooter, and on his the weapon, I believe it was inscribed "My ELF friend," the electromagnetic or extremely low frequency ELF, extremely low frequency. This is apparently one of the tactics that are used for mind control and electronic harassment. We had the case of Miriam Carey, this woman who was gunned down by the Washington police, unarmed. Who were told had some sort of underlying mental health condition, although there were reports that she said she was also hearing voices. Now, one might easily dismiss that as, again, schizophrenia or something, but you start to connect the dots and you start to realize there is something going on. You hear from reputable professional people that this is happening to them. And it makes you wonder. Dr. John Hall is with us, the author of A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America. So educate me here, Dr. Hall. Again, I'm thinking a lot of this stuff is basically ground-based, you know, weaponry or gadgetry, something that you could, you know, take a microwave oven, tear off the door, adapt it somehow, and all of a sudden, you know, you can give your neighbor some sort of, you know, biological effect or disorder, sleep disruption, etc. But you're saying it's gone way beyond that.
Oh yeah, I mean, and I've seen the same website where you've seen that picture, and certainly that can be done. You can certainly develop a weapon that way. It wouldn't be very specific. You wouldn't be able to target an individual very well without being able to see them in the room. I mean, you could certainly target the side of the home and hope the occupants are in that room you're targeting. After I chronicled the story of this girl in San Antonio and my book got released, I was almost immediately bombarded with thousands of emails a day from victims that were experiencing the exact same thing. Coming from a medical perspective, you know, I'm not saying mental illness doesn't exist or schizophrenia doesn't exist or delusional disorder doesn't exist. Certainly it does. But when all of a sudden you see, you know, we estimate 300,000 people all voicing identical complaints about the stalking, identical complaints about initially having tinnitus or ringing in the ears, magnetophosphenes, which are basically flashing lights that you see with your eyes closed when you're trying to go to sleep, which is the same thing we see when you're in an MRI, when your optic nerves are being bombarded with electromagnetic energy. It's a symptom of being bombarded by electromagnetic energy, as well as the hearing voices and the, you know, central nervous system manipulations. Coming from a medical perspective, I have to look at that and say, you know, is this experimentation? It appears to be being done with a manual. You know, there's definitely a methodology about the way it's being done. And then if you look at some of the releases that Snowden's had, you know, about some of the ways they're actually scanning our computers and scanning our phones with continuous wave radar, activating a chip that's placed in the computer that transmits the data off of your screen up to 8 miles away, then it's not too far of a jump to see that this can be used on the brain as well. And a lot of these victims would come to me thinking the same thing, that it was ground-based equipment based on videos or reports they had seen about the LIDA machine out of Russia from the late 70s. And we've taken some of these victims out to desolate ranches where there's no cell phone signals, there's no electrical power lines. They still hear voices. They still get attacked. We've had them on boats in the Gulf of Mexico. They still hear voices. They still get attacked. We've had them 3 stories underground in bunkers that were actually built during the Cold War to prevent bombings. And they still hear voices, and they still get attacked.
You mentioned the voices in the head, and people can go online and see for themselves. I mean, there are patents for voice-to-skull technology, and it's not just a patent and a number. I mean, these have been demonstrated, and on the U.S. Army website, there was information about this. I believe they call it V2K, or voice-to-skull technology. This stuff is real, folks.
Oh, yeah, and if you look at the Army actually came out with a document called the Addendum to the Bioeffects of Non-Lethal Weapons, and they describe to a T the microwave auditory effect. They don't call it V2K, but they do call it the microwave auditory effect, or MAE, and they go on to say its value, which it does have a value. It's not necessarily an evil technology. It's being used for evil mostly right now, but they talk about the value in using this during a hostage crisis where you can communicate with the hostages without the hostage taker hearing. And they go on in this document to talk about using it on enemy combatants and imagine the disorientation they'll have when they begin to hear voices in their head. And they do go on to say that it can't be recorded, even with a microphone placed in the inner ear of the recipient.
Where do the satellites come in now, Dr. Hall? I mean, how are satellites, which are, you know, minimum, what, 200 miles up into the atmosphere or out in space, how do the satellites come into this picture?
Well, actually, once we saw that these victims were hearing this and being attacked, whether they got on a plane, I even had one victim that is financially well off that actually, you know, flew from Texas to Mexico, to Cuba, to South America. He thought if he got into Cuba in a communist country, that maybe this would stop, and was attacked and hearing the voices the whole way on the plane. I've got a physician here that experienced the same thing. You know, there's not many technologies that can track you literally everywhere you go other than satellite. So I called in a favor to a friend of mine that's actually with the CIA and ran this by him and, you know, and said, you know, this is what we're dealing with. What can you tell me without getting yourself in trouble? And he did verify that we do have directed energy weapons platforms on satellite platforms. Now, he didn't necessarily verify the fact that they could communicate voices that way, but he definitely did verify the fact that we have directed energy weapons systems on satellite, which is the other thing that these victims are experiencing. It's not strictly just hearing voices and trying to manipulate them subliminally. It's a lot of times these victims are being zapped with direct forms of directed energy, whether it's microwave or millimeter wave, burns on the skin, burns in the eyes, burns on the genitals, while all along someone is telling them they're doing it in their head. So, and like you said, most of these victims are well-educated, professional people. A lot of the victims I've dealt with have been doctors, have been lawyers, have been whistleblowers with the National Geospatial Agency or the NSA itself.
We use the term they, whoever these perps are, and that's, you know, an entirely different show, I suppose. But do they deliberately choose individuals that are easily discredited because of an already pre-existing condition, whether it's some sort of a mental disorder or perhaps even an addiction?
It would appear that way, and if you look at the MKUltra studies, it was always done that way. In this country, there's really no laws against experimenting on the public, believe it or not. And, you know, if we look in the past, we've Willow Brook School, we've experimented on mentally ill children, we've experimented on prisoners that are incarcerated, we've MKUltra targeted women with postpartum depression, targeted men that were using prostitutes, as well as GIs. So, some of it appears to be random, and some of it appears, at least with whistleblowers, to be very specific.
For the random cases, those people have no clue. They have no, you know, they never worked for a defense contractor. They've never, you know, they're not whistleblowers. What's going on here? You use the term experimentation. So someone's just messing with them because they can and they want to learn what?
Well, I mean, now I'm just extrapolating this because certainly I don't have access to any of the classified documents of it. But it would appear to me when you see that random of a selection, and it is a random selection when the numbers are all crunched, because we've done studies through Freedom from covert surveillance and harassment and questionnaires, that it appears like a random sample and that possibly, you know, as conspiratorial as this sounds, that, you know, they're doing long-term studies to see how effective this will be to use to control a global population. You know, from a medical point of view, shooting that kind of electromagnetic energy at someone for, you know, possibly a decade at a time, you would want to know if there's any weird tumors that are going to arise, any weird blood disorders that are going to arise, because those are the things that are going to cue people off that possibly they're under exposure. So that would be my guess. There's not much other reason to do long-term studies other than to find out those types of things. And a lot of these victims have been victimized for 10 years or greater.
That's the truth. I mean, I've heard some harrowing tales. I know you have, but I've heard some cases where people have been harassed essentially for decades, 30 years in some cases, and how these people are able to hold it together after being essentially tortured. Imagine, tortured for 30 years. Just a testament to their inner strength, really. I mean, what can you do for these people?
Well, I mean, there's some coping mechanisms, and, you know, from some of the studies and that we've done, we have found some ways to not necessarily defeat the technology, but at least deal with the technology. Luckily, I was able to talk to some of the people doing research with directed energy at Brook City Base early on, or at least early on before the book came out. and got some pointers from them on some of the things they use to help the body heal after chronic exposure to electromagnetic fields, which are basically very strong antioxidants. Because as it turns out, when your body is bombarded with electromagnetic radiation for long periods of time, you release a lot of free radicals. And free radicals in the body cause premature aging, can cause cataracts, can cause blood dyscrasias, damage the immune system, open the door for various cancers. So one of the things we do is get them on the right supplementation to at least help defend against the directed energy attack. And some of the research has shown, and from some of the whistleblowers that have worked on the research, has shown that most of this is being done by targeting the EEG of the brain. And there are methods to actually alter the EEG and lessen the ability for them to target.
Literally hacking into our brains. They're literally hacking into our brains.
Yeah, literally hacking into your brains. And if you look at the some of the early research out of Russia that eventually came here with the LIDA machine, which, when we talked, before, you had mentioned that, and that's a term I haven't heard in a long time. That's really old technology, but the LIDA machine was essentially an elk wave generator that was controllable, and they could actually cause hallucinations and to some extent pass data through the LIDA machine into people's brains and make them hear voices or see hallucinations or have audio hallucinations, which is exactly what we're still seeing, but just on a larger scale, and with obviously not being done, at least nothing that's handheld anywhere close to these people.
Well, listen, we're out of time, but I'm glad we met, and I want to get you back on for a much longer period. We'll do that in the near future, and we'll also, there are so many people out there who need, your experience and your sage advice to talk about what's happening to them. I mean, I'm getting the emails, and I can only do so much for them. I can basically talk about it on the air and let them know they're not alone. But if you'd be good enough to come back on soon, and we'll open up the lines and let the people that are being subjected to this electronic torture speak to you directly, that would be a huge benefit to my audience.
Oh, that would be great, Richard. Anytime. I'll be glad to join you.
All right. Well, until then, Dr. John Hall, again, author of A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
All right. Thank you. Tim, thank you for your capable production as always. Next week, Patrick White sitting in the air chair. And then the following week, Victor Vigiani. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed. Nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. Coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.